because we love them.
Them a call us pirates, them a call us illegal broadcasters,
just because we play what the people want.
Episode 10.
Them a call us
illegal broadcasters.
PTI tries to stop us,
but they can't.
They won't.
They cannot stop us. Welcome to episode 10 of the Interracial John Podcast. I am your host at Leslie Mack.
And I'm at Very White Guy.
And you are very white indeed. As I said, welcome to episode 10. So exciting, episode 10.
It is exciting.
Jeez. Came up fast.
Like a month and a bit.
Goodness.
Well done.
All right. Well, you can find us. We are coming at you from the suburbs of Philadelphia, and you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. You can just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. And as we've amassed now going on our 10th episode, we are finally ready to ask people to leave us some reviews. So we are looking to get some reviews on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And if you leave a 5-star review, we will read it on air. Is that right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I know a few other podcasts who do
borrow
this.
That.
We'll borrow that.
Five-star
that rule.
Review,
so
yeah.
5-star review, you get your comments read on air. Again,
that's anything, right? That's you could like basically write anything.
Yep.
Let's leave it that interpretation. You can write anything. We'll read it. 5 stars.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right.
Pretty much. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Interracial John. That's again J-A-W-N. And if you want, you can use the show's hashtag, which is IRJ, hashtag IRJ. And finally, you can also find us on our website, interracialjohn.com, where we have our podcast, Interracial John Podcast, and we have two spinoff podcasts that one launched last week, and we're doing episode 2 of the first one, which is the White Privilege Podcast, hosted by Very White Guy himself, along with Drum Beats for Peace. So you guys are doing episode 2 this coming Wednesday.
Yep.
That's kind of exciting, episode 2 of that. And then Friday, we're launching our second spinoff, which is called No Bitch Left Behind, and it will be myself, Lazzy Mack, along with the Lady J. And we are going to be talking about issues related to feminism, sexism, misogyny, and issues that come up for women.
And BLB.
And intersectionality. It says MBLB, No Bitch Left Behind. And you can follow Lady J on Twitter at Parenthetics. That's T-I-X dot... Oh, just Parenthetics, at Parenthetics. You can follow her
nice.
On Twitter. So, yeah, look out for those two coming out. And we'll be, of course, doing the John Podcast twice a week. So, yeah.
Keep it going.
All right, well, let's get into it now that all that housekeeping's out of the way.
Yeah.
We had a fun weekend, lots of podcasting and stuff this weekend.
Totally.
So yesterday we were invited to be guests on episode 13 of the AUA podcast.
Right. Ricky
Americans
and,
United
Sherelle.
Again. That's right. Ricky and Sherelle. We had an awesome time with them.
Very fun.
Just a lot of public, current events and, mostly current events, right? That's
yeah, I would say it's maybe, Americans United again. So that's actually their website is AmericansUnited.org. And it was very fun. And I like Ricky's perspective. I didn't know he was, an ex-veteran.
Yeah, he's a veteran.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Served veteran.
Yep.
And he did have a blog post that he referenced that I didn't read, but I read between then and now. It was actually pretty kind of interesting. It was about the sort of theory that people bandy about, the rhetoric that black people are lazy, right? The sort of...
Right, the myth.
Know, the I guess
right, the myth.
But he wrote, black people who are jobless consistently continue to seek employment at a higher rate than whites. Statistics theory using, so that's his comments. And he's got this sort of, when you see statistics, they present something and you kind of have to sort of like, well, what are they really trying to tell me? What are they not telling
right,
me?
Right, you got
to
like dig in there.
Right, so he's using some standard job information, who's seeking a job, who's not seeking a job. But I tend to agree with his assessment that, based on the percentages that, the statistics are showing that not only black people not lazy, they're more seeking employment when there's fewer employment opportunities for them at the same time as their equal counterparts that are white.
Right, exactly. And it's great when you get to see somebody put together content like that that's just taking a myth that is accepted by a lot of people
sure.
and giving empirical evidence to show why it's a myth and it's not correct at all. So we appreciate that. We do that with our Ferguson flashcards, and I just love content that kind of sticks it in the face of these ridiculous suppositions put forth.
I go both ways with statistics. You know, I agree that they can be valuable, but actual empirical studies show that when people are presented with facts, that they're less inclined to sort of believe your opinion. And I do think, as a, you know, someone who's studied some statistics for a bit, given a data set, right? Just, you know, not the actual, what I present to you isn't the data set.
Right.
It's how I've shown
right,
you the
data. Right, it's your interpretation
set.
Yeah, of
and it. There's a myriad. There's like, you know, thousands of different statistical analyses and regressions and, you know, different graphs and ways to display information. But given a data set, you know, a good statistician can argue both sides of a coin using the different ways to sort of, you know, for lack of a better way, massage that data. And I had a professor, he had this quote that I loved, said, statistics are like a string bikini in that the what they reveal to you is interesting, but what they conceal is crucial. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was pretty, and I think Ricky sort of done that as well, sort of that, you know, what this initial statistic would show you maybe could be used by somebody to argue that, like, oh, look, you know, blacks aren't working as much, they're more unemployed blacks. But then you're like, well, but let's look at the data a little bit differently, and wow, golly, there's actually more people of color looking for work than there are white people that are, you know, as a percentage of those that are unemployed.
Sure.
So it's, again, you know, I thought it was good, really good job, and you can follow them there at aua.org on Twitter, but I don't think they tweet much. He said he's not on Twitter as much, so maybe...
Yeah, well, I think he just hates Twitter because he doesn't like being so, like, short-winded, or he feels like you can't really, you know, combat people's thoughts in 140 characters, which I do appreciate. I mean, it's definitely a different type of interaction. You have to kind of go into it knowing that you're not going to be able to.
I would say, Ricky, don't make the mistake if you're listening. I hope you do. Don't twit longer, please.
Hate the twit longer.
Jesus. There's somebody that I might have muted or unblocked him. They were using twit longer to, like, reply to shit. And you'd see the original tweet, and then the twit longer would be like another, like, 13 characters. I'm like,
yeah,
are you,
kinda
did
like
you
13
make me
characters?
Fucking open another page to read?
Use some abbreviations.
Come on.
How about that? Use an and symbol for cripe's sake.
You know, the 140 character limit, I understand it, you know, doesn't allow you to get everything you want.
Right.
You have some brevity, but I think that is like a benefit. I mean, for me, it's forced me to certainly...
What's a distiller?
Yeah, well, it makes me think differently. I have to be more concise.
Right.
I have to figure
that's
out
what I mean.
It
like, it makes
characters.
You really, like, distill your thoughts. And also, oftentimes, I'm like, if I can't fit it in, I'm like, you know what? Then it
doesn't belong
here.
There. Yeah.
And that's okay. It's meant for somewhere else.
In the beginning, I used to have a bunch of, like, saved, like, I would start typing it, and I couldn't figure out how to condense it and what my thoughts I wanted to. So I'd, like, save it as a draft. I have, like, 40 saved draft tweets. And I've stopped doing that. I've been maybe a little bit more efficient.
Yeah. Well, it helps that we now have 4 hours a week that we just record ourselves saying what the hell we want to, Sue.
That's true. That's very, very true. I tweeted that. I tweeted that I love podcasting with you because it's fucking fun.
It is fun. All right. Well, I know we wanted to talk a little bit about religion, our religion, Unitarian Universalism, and some things that have been going on within the faith and for both of us, and certainly for me. Just a little background, if you don't know anything about Unitarian Universalists, we are an all-inclusive religion that have 7 principles that we stand by. I won't go through all of them, but the number one principle is belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people.
And, you know, if you have them up, number 2 is, like, justice and equality for everybody, too.
Yeah.
So it's – anyway, go on. Sorry.
So we belonged – past tense for myself, to a congregation here in our neck of the woods. And subsequent to, I've been working on issues related to social justice in New Jersey for a number of years now, some through our congregation, but mostly through a larger group of people within the religion here in New Jersey. And the response from our actual congregation with regard to issues of race, specifically about Ferguson and Mike Brown, just wasn't the move for me.
Well, you're even being, I'll clarify 2 things. You've been working pretty, I would say, tirelessly and with the legislative ministries in New Jersey. You guys got Ban the Box done. You've got bail reform on the ballot, you know, this year. It's work. When you started doing this, I thought, you know, I don't want to do the legislative stuff. I don't see it's too long of an arc, but I'm blown away by what you guys have done in the short period of time. So that's one. And two, you know, I'll let you continue talking, but basically people listening, you know, this faith is a very liberal, very progressive. You know, we have an LGBT minister, you know, there's atheists, there's, you know, Christians, Jews, all sorts of denominations that are there.
Pagans,
you know,
Wiccans.
We are as I think in terms of like if you're looking at the various faith beliefs, secular humanist is maybe at the top because it's not religious at all. And then right below that's probably UUism in terms of it's like how left-leaning and how liberal of a religious
right.
faith community it is.
But much like most, I think, progressive liberals in this country, the issue of race is a complicated one and one they're not really ready to address.
I was going to just say in summation that the community at large and our church specifically are predominantly homogeneously white, upper middle class,
well educated. Yep.
And there's, you know, I want to talk about the sort of continuum where people are, but I would just say the response, honestly, from our church, this isn't just like a group of people, this is from our church. It included like, wait for the fucking facts,
yep.
man. It included fucking.
We don't know what happened.
It was like fucking broke my heart, man. It really.
Yeah.
It just. And I think UUism as a whole is in a crisis. You know, I think that this is a. I hope that this is a pivotal moment.
It's funny because the more and more I've been thinking about this and I've been talking with other black UUs the past couple of weeks about it. And the more I think about it, the more I see the issues in the UU faith and with the organizing body that is the UUA, which is the larger organization right. of Unitarian Universalists, the association, if you will, mirroring kind of what's going on in the country because we have allowed the issue of race to be swept under the rug.
Sure.
And the UU faith has allowed the same thing. Like they were involved in, you know, the march in Selma, although they were a little behind the curve then as well, but they were involved in the civil rights movement. They've been very involved in the LGBTQ fight for marriage equality. They're huge into environmentalism, but race, this thing, they don't get it. They don't get it because it doesn't affect them. And they don't have this connection of, okay, well, this our minister's gay and he can't get married. That's not fair. This parishioner whose house I go to all the time is gay and they can't get married and that's not fair. When you don't have people of color or a good number of them within a faith, it becomes intentional otherizing because they are other. They're not the norm. And so it's allowed this atmosphere to foster where they don't even want to step out of themselves and make a statement and say, hey, look, this is fucked up and we're not going to just sit around and say that it's not.
You know, it's funny you say that. I've been meaning to have this sort of discussion with you and I hope it's related, not tangential, but we've talked, you and I personally, about the fact that the winds of change when it came to marriage equality specifically and LGBT, equality, it absolutely came in some sort of step with or correlation to the number of people coming out and saying, I'm a member of the LGBT community.
Absolutely.
And you saw it. There were senators that are like, you know, I have this, I'm a Republican, this is my viewpoint, and I'm, you
well,
know,
you
the Bible
know, Tim,
is my
Tim
opinion.
Tim Cook came out officially
right,
freaking weekend. So, it's top news.
So, you and I have talked about is there's not a real way for people of color to come out.
Right.
You can't, there's no equivalent that people, because you're here, you've been suffering, it's nothing fucking new, right? I think the equivalent in terms of a bellwether, like when we're going to, you know, when's the world going to start to change more? I feel like it's going to be when white people not only don't not talk about it, but they aggressively confront it and they talk about it openly. And there's a lot of people, and we talked a little bit about the person last week that I was tweeting with that was having some issues with their family. I feel like there's people that listen to the podcast that Drumbeats and I did that are saying to themselves, you know, wow, this is exactly what I'm thinking about. I can't say that at work.
Right.
I can't talk like that in
Absolutely.
My own home. I can't speak out like that in the community and the place I live. And that's a shame. That's like literally like, I don't know what it is, like the white privilege closet maybe or something. You know, maybe that's fair to say to LGBT communities, use their closet specifically. But I think when white people not only are understanding and compassionate and aware, but they're actively with just all you have to do is just in your voice. You don't have to be, you know, in Ferguson. You don't have to do things that you know, you don't want to do or dangerous. Just call a fucking thing a thing. Be fucking real. Be honest and say what it is. Let's
right.
not, you know, this whole like not talk about it. You know, newsflash, that's not working.
Yeah.
You know, Black people are dying. Let's start fucking talking about it, please.
I think the other thing that's come into play for me personally with the faith is that, you know, me not wanting to be part of this one congregation doesn't make me any less of a UU.
No.
And that fact and me not wanting to be a person who 5 years from now was like, well, I never did anything to make my faith stood up and take notice. And I never tried to change my faith from within. It's not right. It's not what UUism is about. It's not what me as a UU is about. Well, so I kind of...
That's part and parcel with the personal journey, though.
Absolutely, it's part and parcel with it. We champion your own personal journey in spirituality and in religion as a UU. And so for me, it's been interesting being able to talk to other Black UUs about these issues and how a lot of them have been feeling the same way that I've been feeling, just kind of like, you know, when is our faith going to match up with its principles with regard to race? And so in a lot of the discussions, not just with Black UUs, but with like-minded white UUs that are feeling the same way, like, you know, like all of this is falling onto deaf ears, we came to the same conclusion that a lot of the protesters and leaders in Ferguson came to, that these old channels of leadership are not going to be the ones to make this change happen. It's not going to be the UUA. It's not going to be the NAACP. It's going to have to come from A, younger people, B, people that are willing to do one-on-one work, because that's where it just has to start at this point.
Well, you can't be that far removed from the pain, literally, the pain, right? If you're what you're talking about, I think, is on some level bureaucratic, you know, dysfunction. It happens in any organization, the U.S. government.
But I wouldn't call it dysfunction, because what it is that these organizations are meant to work from a top-down organizational level. And that works with some things. If you're talking about getting the vote out. If you're talking about specific, like, Black or white issues, top-down works great. You have a message. You drill it down. You have marketing pieces, you have a brand, you push it down to the people, and they spread that information. But this is not what this is.
I take it a step further. The analogy I think you're looking for is Arab Spring. You know, it's a revolution of sorts. And for, you know, there to be a revolution, there's going to be different tools, different media. You know, Twitter was so important in so many ways. And, you know, like you said, these traditional top-down approaches, when you've got sort of an organization telling you this is what we should do and this is how we should do it, that works for some things, but not what's going on today, not this revolution. And they're just, you know, it's a fundamental shift. Things are different for, you know, how to get things done. It has simply changed. And the old guard and the old way of doing things and the sort of, like you say, top-down dissemination, here's the message, here's the information, and go do this, that's effective for some things. It's not going to be effective to make the social change that we're talking about that's needed in this world, that Michelle Alexander calls in her book, you know, nothing short of a revolution. And I don't want to, when I say the word revolution, you know, I hope, like, people don't think, like, I'm talking about, like, Duns and, like, actual real revolution.
Or, like, taking over the government.
Yeah,
nothing. No, it's a social revolution.
It's a social revolution.
It's a social revolution. It's a change of consciousness. It's a social awakening. Yeah.
An awakening. The first revolution is from within.
Right.
And I, you know, I always try to use I statements. Mine was August 9th. You know, I was on Twitter. I was just getting involved in Twitter. I was becoming a Twitter addict. And there was a million tweets about Mike Brown and Ferguson before any news outlet even mentioned the word, right? And it just, something made me snap. It woke me up.
Out of these discussions that I've been having, there's a group of UUs that are on Facebook specifically that are talking about issues related to mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow. And so we had a couple of discussions. I'd posted a few things of examples of where the UUA has, in my opinion, gone too soft or not at all with regard to race, while they speak out so strongly and call to arms on so many other issues. And, you know, was really met with, I would say, 50% people like, yeah, you're totally right. This is bullshit and they need to be doing this. And then, you know, 50% bureaucratic BS excuses for why it's okay that they're not doing the things that I think need to be done. And I came to this conclusion, like, you know what? I got these people here. They're listening to me. Why do we need the UUA for anything? We're individuals. Each of our congregations can do whatever they want to do. That's part and parcel of being a UU. There is nothing the same about any UU congregation with the exception of these seven principles. And so I started a new group and I called it RUU Awake. And we're going to be working on developing curriculum, resources, and connections to start at our congregation and personal levels in all over the country, hopefully, to awaken our congregations from the bottom up.
Yep.
And, you know, the UUA can decide to come along or they cannot. It'd be fantastic if they did a series of discussions at every single UU congregation about white privilege. That would be fucking amazing.
That would.
I would hope to God that's taking over.
Okay.
Taking over or supporting and doing the same kind of work. I think it would be amazing, powerful, and huge for our religion. Do I think they're going to do that? Hell no, I don't think they're going to do that.
Just as an aside, I'm doing it at our house with people from our congregation next week.
Yeah. So anyway, so the first action that we are doing for everyone is to have a small group discussion surrounding the history of racial injustice. And we hope to have everybody involved in their local congregations have this scheduled by November 15th and have each of these small discussions completed by December 15th. And so we're going to just facilitate, we're going to have everybody read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Case of Reparations article and then have a discussion about what the historical context of institutionalized racism is in this country, which I think a lot of white people are just not clued in or aware of.
Yep.
And then how our faith calls us to address those things. And I'm interested to see the feedback on it and how many we get scheduled. I really want to be documenting, you know, the number of conversations that happened, the number of people that went to them, because I hope it's a small ember. And when I named the group RUU Awake, it's a question to ask ourselves and then to ask our faith. And so I'm excited about it. And I'll report back about what happened.
I'm pleased with the number of people that joined right away. I'm thrilled that you've set it up with specific action items and I would say a very appropriate and not grand, you know, a grand mission, but a very specific mission. And I think it's terrific. I just,
yeah,
you know, and I think it's, what, like, who is it? Kenny Wiley. He's, I think, he's in seminary school, but he wrote the sort of the post, you know, are you going to answer the call? And I feel.
Yeah, the question he asks is, who are my people?
Yeah.
And who are my people?
And I just feel like, I hope. So, and I didn't even tell you too much of this, but I went to church today.
Yep.
We haven't been in months because of sort of this schism. And I didn't go to service, but I went to sort of help one of our friends talk about question one here in New Jersey, bail reform.
So yeah, and if you're in New Jersey and you're voting Tuesday, please vote yes. Question one, bail reform. Please.
So I was there helping our friend talk about it and sort of, you know, get people informed.
Yeah, get the word out.
Yeah, I didn't know, I guess on a side note, that the registry or the ballot came out. Some people voted early. And they told me that the way that question one was phrased
it's very shady and very Republican.
Deliberately worded.
Yeah, to make it look like people won't get bond.
Yeah.
And it's not at all what it is meant. And this is why we've had to campaign so hard to make sure people understand that you want to vote yes, even though it says that what it's going to do. We had to change in order to get the signing.
You had to get.
No, it's not even about the signing. The way the Constitution is worded, in order to put different bail restrictions in that aren't minimum anymore, you have to open up the option for the judge to deny bail. It just is a matter of the way that our Constitution in this state is worded. So you cannot have one without the other. If we put a law in place that gives judge discretion on bail, you have to have them able to deny bail as well. And the way our Constitution was written previously, that was prohibited. And so that's what the question is taking away that particular provision in our Constitution, which will allow the actual bail reform bill that was passed earlier this year to kick in and have real bail restrictions put in our justice system here in New Jersey.
Nevertheless, the point of the story was I was at church and a lot of people came up, like not a few, like, you know, like a dozen or more, and just sort of, you know, gave me a hug and said, oh, we really miss you and Leslie and how are you guys doing? And, you know, it's so sad that you're not here. We really feel bad, you know, and there wasn't any sort of, you know, what's going on, this or that. But the person I was with said that earlier this week there was a discussion at church about white privilege.
Yep.
And there was almost 18 people, which I thought was a lot.
Which is a lot. I mean, our church is not huge.
For the size of our congregation.
Yeah.
And he said that in the beginning, they're going around and said, you know, what are you hoping to do and why are you here? Not one, not two, but I guess quite a few people said, well, I'm here because we apparently failed, you know, Drew and Leslie, and they've left. And there's something there, and we need to figure it out. And I thought, you know what? I don't think we could have done anything. I disengaged because I felt like I was pissing people off. I just wasn't willing to have a conversation. And maybe I'm different now. I'm a little bit, you know, more understanding. But I just wasn't able to have that conversation when it's like, wait for the facts and everybody has two sides. I would kind of like flip out, and it just wasn't good, wasn't conducive. And I didn't want to be that person to these people that I care about. So we, for our own sanity, we kind of like, listen, let's just disengage. But it seems to have had perhaps a good effect, that some people have taken that as a sign that maybe there's work to be done. And I, you know, that pleases me, I guess.
And I think you'll be continuing that work when you know, have everybody over this week, or the people that are coming on Wednesday to have discussion with one of our favorite local organizers, Frank Stiefel from CCOP here at the house. I won't be here because it's going to be a bunch of white people talking about race, and I don't want to make them uncomfortable, but I think it'll be great.
We didn't talk about that. And it's so, again, like, you forget how your privilege takes over sometimes. And we've been together almost 2 decades. And it's weird sometimes that my privilege is so, even though I have a black wife and all these, you know, relatives and people in my family, you know, I'm as compassionate as I can be. I still forget sometimes. Like, it just sort of like almost slips my mind. And when you said, like, oh, I think I'm going to not be there for this because I don't want my presence to in any way, even slightly, one just smidgen of doubt that someone would have because there's a person of color here, to not be able to be genuine in that moment would be negative. It would detract from what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And it kind of like, I was like, of course, that makes perfect sense. But at the same time, I was like, how did I not fucking think about that? It's almost like, you know what I mean? Like, the privilege is so just, it's just deep. It's everywhere. It's the atmosphere. And
I mean,
just but
I wouldn't call
it.
That privilege. I just think that's your POV. I don't
but
think
that,
it's privilege.
Point of view is not privilege, but it just, you know, like I said, it sometimes just.
But I mean, you can't expect everybody to be always putting themselves in other people's shoes. That's crazy.
No.
That's
but you're
just,
my wife. This is an event.
Yeah, but still, we know these people. It's not, you know, completely out of the realm that you wouldn't have thought I wouldn't want to be there. My thing is, like, I do want them to be able to be honest, but I also really don't want to sit in a room and listen to white people, like, get explained about white privilege. I just don't have any interest in it.
I cannot.
God bless you.
You
all, but I just don't have any interest in it. That's why I left the church.
Yeah.
Because that's not where I want to put my efforts.
We won't talk about it here because Drumbeats and I are literally going to be talking about
that. Well, let's move
on
then. Speaking of making your presence known, Mike Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, will be headed to Geneva, Switzerland next month to talk to the UN about her son and other victims of police brutality in front of the United Nations. It's really just breaking news. Just came out last week. While the killing of Mike Brown is still under investigation by federal officials, and we're waiting, of course, for that grand jury announcement, few in Ferguson and few anywhere in this country believe that an actual indictment is going to happen. And so McSpadden, Leslie, with a couple of lawyers and local activists and human rights advocates from Ferguson are taking her son's case and that of other victims of racial profiling and police violence directly to the UN Committee Against Torture, the body tasked with preventing torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and punishment around the world.
Hear, hear.
The trip, which has recently been made public by the organizers and promoted under the tagline Ferguson to Geneva, is meant to make a case to as wide an audience as possible that both Brown's killing and the militarized police response to protesters demanding justice for him are a matter of human rights. Quote, it's actually covered by Article 1 of the Convention Against Torture. Justin Hansford, a law professor at St. Louis University and a co-author of a brief to the UN body filed by Brown's family and local activists. When the government has all the guns, all the force, and when they can kill people with impunity and without fear of being found guilty of a crime, that's a classic example. You see this in dictatorships and regimes where they do this to their own citizens and they get away with it, he added. He compared Brown's killing to that of Emmett Till in the 1950s, a pivotal moment behind the civil rights movement of the following years. Quote, the murder of Mike Brown was a fresh cut in an old wound in the sense that it played on the legacy of lynching. When black people's bodies were on display for people as a form of intimidation, Hansford said, referring to Brown's body, which laid on the street for more than 4 hours. Brown's death, he added, wasn't just a violation of people's civil rights. It was a violation of their human rights. And so they're framing this as a human rights issue in an attempt to speak to people's empathy. Charles Wade, one of the protesters and one of the organizers, said people are starting to understand that people of color often feel that they don't have the same rights as humans, that their humanity isn't being respected. A person may not have seen it in that way, so they may now think, yeah, all lives do matter. I do care. How can I help? So the UN delegation is yet another attempt to shift the terms of the conversation on Ferguson and to appeal for the support of the broader community. As we started to think about what the situation was in the larger context, we started to link what's happening in the U.S. in terms of police violation, police violence and human rights violations. Our mid and long-term work will be linking what happened in Ferguson and what's happening in other places where there's excessive police violence to the international struggle for human rights. So they first thought of taking this to the UN because there's a group of youth of color in Chicago that are also planning to go to Geneva. They announced this fall, and they're dubbing their campaign We Charge Genocide.
Right, and that's a follow-up that was done in the civil rights movement the first time
around. Right, and so they're doing it again. So they're going to be trying to go November 12th and 13th. And in addition to McSpadden and the attorney, Daryl Parks, Hansford, who I mentioned, and Wade, there's also going to be four local activists, including one Taff Poe, are also going. And while they admit that it's largely symbolic because they don't expect the U.S. to take action based on this, it really is about taking the conversation to the global community and saying, look, we're always out here trying to police the world. And this is what's going on in our country.
And of course,
we know that Amnesty International came out and had a, just glaring condemnation of the activities that have been going on.
They focused on a lot of things, but the press, there's just
the press, the peaceful protester response, and also, we know now from news that the police are gathering riot gear and rubber bullets and tear gas, are stockpiling them in anticipation of the grand jury decision. So, I'm scared because I know that this is coming. I think that we've been hearing any day now, literally. We're now November 2nd recording this today. So I've heard they expect it from anywhere from the 4th through the 10th, with the 10th being a date that's definitely been thrown out a lot. It's a tenuous time, and I'm really praying for everybody there and for our country, really, because it's going to be a tough time for us. But,
the human rights angle and element, I'll just say that, we live here outside of Philadelphia. And when Michael Vick became our quarterback, the number of people I know in my circle that were just outraged. Right? And I'm not defending him having a dog fighting ring and killing dogs. But he was tried, convicted, Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary for like 2 years, lost everything, $100 million contracts, can he not try to have a career? Like, you don't want him to go back to crime. Let's allow him to have a job. It was like just ridiculous, not ridiculous, but the people that were just, I will never watch an Eagles game again. They just were so upset. And we've seen this locally too. You and I talked about what's the value of black lives. And it's on some level, it feels like, unfortunately, lower than that of fucking pets. I have pets. I love my dogs. They're great. But it's not a human being. I put it in a cage at night sometimes, But if you're a cop and you shoot a beloved pet, holy fuck, the entire world comes down on you.
Yeah, we were listening to a live stream from Ferguson. Actually, I think it was from New York City, with a bunch of activists. And Renisha Boyd's, Rakia Boyd's brother was there. And, she was the woman who was shot in the back of the head in some sort of raid. Pretty terrible situation. But he made a comment that, he didn't want to see this as racial. He didn't want to see it racially, but he started looking into more information, and he discovered that this police department, this was in Chicago, they had killed a woman's dog. They'd shot the dog and killed the dog, and they had issued a public and personal apology to this woman for the death of this dog. And they never said anything to his family about him losing his sister. And it really, you know, broke his heart. Just the thought of that they were actually sorry about this dog's death, but that they, in not doing anything, were basically saying that his sister deserved to die, and yeah. they were fine with it. So
when the whole Ray Rice business came about, you made that infographic about, you know, where do you fall on the protection and yeah. value of life yeah. chart. And you can find it on IRJ Thoughts on our website. There's a few other flashcards there, but it just made me think of that. They're just,
yeah, for sure. You've got to go to Geneva. Right at the bottom. Black women, they're down there at the very, very bottom. Anyways, let's move to some slightly less serious topics, which was Halloween was Friday. We boycotted Halloween.
That was fun. We got to do that.
I'm doing that every year, man.
I love giving out candy to the kids. It's so fun. I do. You know, I go off on
Halloween.
Damn candy. I like Halloween.
You know, these kids, they not got nothing but germs all over them
all
the time.
But you didn't see when I was around in the neighborhood. There's a lot of vans of kids from
sure. Look, they got enough candy. They didn't need our candy.
I know.
It's just fine. We can opt
people
out.
People come to our neighborhood to trick-or-treat, and I like to be able to participate.
Well, whatever. We boycotted this year. We went to the movies and dinner with some friends, but, you know, the internets was kind enough to give us a taste of what America was dressing up as.
Why don't you start with
Halloween.
The worst? Start with the fucking Ray Rice ones.
No, we'll go to that after, because I kind of want to segue into something else there. But okay. There was one that was a little, like, I don't even know if you and I agreed about it. So those who don't know, a gentleman named Edward on Twitter, his handle is iFloodPanties.
Best handle ever.
It is the best handle ever. He is actually the person in the iconic photo that was taken during the initial Ferguson protests, right, in the earlier days, where he was in an American flag shirt, and he was throwing tear gas back at the police that had been thrown at the protesters, and he has a bag of Riblets potato chips open in his hand. So it's really iconic. He's got dreads and the American flag and the light from the tear gas. Anything. It's I think it's probably going to win. You know,
photo of the
I don't even know what.
Well, I've tweeted a couple times, but maybe we should start for real, like an actual hashtag movement. Riblets for Edward. Which is fucking. I'd never heard of hot Riblets.
Me
Old
either.
Vienna, Old
Never
Vienna,
heard of it.
At Old Vienna LLC is the Twitter handle. Old Vienna LLC, yeah. Makers
of
Riblets.
He needs a deal or something. I never heard of Riblets before.
Just give him free Riblets. Send the fucking dude bags of Riblets.
Bags.
That's all I'm saying.
He's always got Riblets on
You've
him.
Never heard of fucking Riblets.
Well,
and
anyways,
that was his first tweet was that, oh, by the way,
Those are Riblets. Hot Riblets. Anyway, so somebody went as Edward for Halloween.
Very convincingly.
They had, you know, he had the bandana around his face because, you know, they were getting tear gas on them. He had the shirt. I think he had a wig that was a dread wig. And he had the Riblets, and he had a fake can of tear gas. And I didn't know how to feel about it. I really didn't like it. I thought it was kind of disrespectful, personally speaking.
I disagreed. I don't know why I disagree, but I didn't find it necessarily disrespectful. I guess, it was a black person.
Yeah.
And if it was certainly a white person trying to be Edward, I might have been like, okay, what the fuck? But you sort of felt that, you know, this is somebody who is protecting kids and family. It was a protest.
No, I just feel like, you know, that image is, I mean, let me just say this. Would you be offended by somebody who was dressed up as JFK and had their brain blown apart?
I know it's been done. I've seen it.
I haven't seen it. I've never seen it.
With a Jackie with blood on her dress. Absolutely.
Oh, well, that would offend me, too. And it should be offensive.
That's a little bit more offensive than this, because Edward... I don't know why.
If you say so, I disagree. Yeah, I just feel like, you know, when you... Here's how I think of it. If the costume is meant to evoke a certain image, and I think of what that image was and what it represents, it's not something that's a costume. It is a moment where a community was under siege and being attacked by those who they pay to protect them. And I don't find that something that has any levity in it.
More reverence. I hear you.
And so that's where I went with it. I just think that there's some things that it's like, yeah, you're not, that's not something that you want to be dressed up
as. I'll give you this. So here's the, you know,
there's a picture of 9/11, and, you know, right when the buildings came down and there were people on the street, and my sister was one of these people covered in dust and soot from, you know, they were all gray. Would you be okay with somebody walking into
a better example? Would you go as a first responder?
No, you can go as a first responder. You can be a firefighter. That's a costume. That's a job function.
Well, 911 first responder is not something I think.
But how would you designate that?
All right, so if there was, what's the iconic 9/11 photo? The guys with the flag and going as one of those people? That
I don't even. I would say because Edward is not a police officer. He's a person. So if you took, there's plenty of iconic. There's one iconic one of the woman that's sitting on the side and her she's covered in soot and she has black stuff running down her face. She's in a suit. If you went as her, that's offensive.
Yeah, that's offensive.
You're and right. It's the same thing. It's just because he's a black person and he happens to be iFlood panties online. And he had riblets in his hand and he has dreads that people think it's a costume, but he's a real person. And this was a very serious situation that he was in.
Yeah, I guess I didn't see the person that did it necessarily as being disrespectful. I thought more, you know, like homage, but I hear what you're saying. And I do think that the moment and the movement and that image, they're all, you know, intertwined. It's the image of the movement. Right. And on that level, you know, I think I agree with you. That's perhaps, you know, not appropriate.
I'm not trying to convince you or anybody else. No, I'm just giving my take on it and why I think some things can be a costume and some things cannot. And I just, when you look at the heart of what that image is, what it represents, and what was happening to him.
As an even better example, would you dress as one of the iconic images from, you know, the first civil rights movement, the lunch counter, right? Would you dress as somebody that was, you know, not able to sit at the lunch counter? Probably not.
With ketchup on their head? Yeah. No, you're not going to dress like that.
Everyone knows that's pretty disrespectful.
It is disrespectful.
Okay. Well, what are some of the other, let's do the other costumes.
So there were some funny ones, though, kind of more, when I thought that were in good taste. So, you know, the ALS challenge that was going everywhere over the summer.
The ice bucket?
The ice bucket challenge. So somebody dressed up as the ice bucket challenge, and he had like a stick that had a bucket above his head, and then he had fake ice cubes stuck all over to his face and his shirt and everything.
That's
I thought it was
good.
Really funny.
It was he went as the ALS challenge.
He went as the ALS challenge. I thought it was good. Pretty funny.
You
might have
got some kudos at a party.
Yeah, for sure. I thought people would have like, oh, that's kind of neat. It's timely. And this is an example of like, that's a costume. It's not anything sliding on a movement or anything. It's funny. That's funny.
Well, and I'll just say you generally don't. You don't like people dressing up as other people as often. You prefer them dressing as a concept, an idea, something witty. If you go as an actual person, if you dislike that person, it's okay. But if you like that person, you're like, they shouldn't dress that person.
No, it's not about that. I just think that's not true. Like, I think people dressing up as Beyonce and Jay-Z is awesome.
Right.
I think when white people do it and have to put blackface on, it's not so awesome.
We don't want to talk about that. That's ridiculous.
Well, we will talk about that. But anyways, and then you know that black guy who's the Darren Wilson supporter? He's in all those memes.
Yeah.
So I saw a few people that went as him.
And what do you think about that? Is that okay?
I think it's funny.
I think it's kind of funny.
Because we don't know anything about that dude, really. They're going as the meme. That's how I see it with that.
Well, and if you're, even if you did know whether you're homaging for Edward Eiffel panties, you're definitely mocking this guy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that
the meme
is mocking. And I, like I said, you're going as a meme. You are going as a meme because that's really all he is. I don't even know his name.
There was one I saw that was really like had the same polo, same phone.
Same thing, same spot on. And then we take a turn to the dregs of our society.
I saw a tweet where somebody said, for Halloween, can like art supply and like makeup places, just can you put blackface makeup behind the counter? Can that be like a show your ID? Like, can it be like we treat what's the amphetamine that comes in prescription or not prescription, but like Sudafed?
Sudafed.
Yeah, you can't buy Sudafed unless you go to the pharmaceutical counter. I think
you can't buy blackface until a black person says you can.
Buy brown or blackface until you get like a notarized approval from one of my friends, a black person.
Well,
somebody. Anyways,
of course, we saw the horrible, disgusting white people in blackface dress up as Ray Rice and Janae Rice. Which is like, let's just hit every obnoxious, disgusting category we can. You know, sexist, check. Anti-domestic violence, check, check. Racist, triple check. Why? Why would you need to do that?
The two or three that I saw were people like proud. Like, look at my dad.
Oh,
he's fucking awesome.
And people,
really?
Somebody dressed their child up. Blackface as Ray Rice. Some guy I saw had a blow-up doll with an afro and painted and was like dragging it around. I just...
Girlfriend with a fake black eye. Just
really? Really?
White people just...
My thing is like, why would that be something you want to dress up as?
Yeah, and that's the
guess. That's the part I don't get.
But that's part of what I was saying before, like the pivotal moment when white people speak up. The pivotal moment when that person has that thought, sets foot out of their house, and every person around them, neighbor, driver, is like, holy Jesus, are you in blackface? What the fuck is wrong with you? Like, really. That,
well...
Because that's how I feel. Like, what the fuck
Yeah, that's
is wrong
how you feel. And what would you say if you not if oh you, if you saw that person, what would you say
I'd,
to them?
I'd stop the car. I'd literally get out and be like, are you fucking kidding me? I'd give them a lesson right there, a history lesson on blackface and what it means and why it was in place. And, oh, my God. It's so – I don't get it.
I just feel I like, you know what? You have every fucking thing, white people. You have everything. Why do you need to be a black person for Halloween, too? Why? Because you have to have every goddamn thing. Dress up as somebody else. And I also want to mention all these other people out here thinking that just because the person you dress up as is a different race, that you need to have the same color skin as that person.
Yeah.
It's not necessary. I will know that you're goddamn Beyonce when you have on a bodysuit, stockings, and a mesh fucking mask. I know it's her. I don't need you to put blackface on too. Go see any goddamn Comic-Con cosplay committee convention, and you'll see exactly how that's done.
Yeah, not needed.
Get a
people.
Fucking life. All that says to me is that the other 364 days of the year, you're a goddamn racist, and you're happy to show it when you're able to.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I was talking with this on Twitter, and it got confused with somebody, but, you know, in your evolution of understanding as a white person and trying to do better, you know better, you do better. You got to be able to be like, okay, I made a mistake. I own it. Shit. I'll never do that again. There are some mistakes that they just, I don't want to say they should be unrecoverable. They're you know, just unexcusable. And for me, blackface is right.
Because that's
hair,
not
man.
A, that's not a mistake.
It's not.
It's
that's
a
what
decision.
I mean.
That's my entire point.
Yeah,
you have to make so many decisions. You have to conceive of it. You have to purchase the items to do it. You have to dress yourself up as it.
I mean
you have to look in the goddamn mirror and then leave your house looking like that because you think it's okay.
I'm not willing to accept ignorance. Is what I mean to say is in that situation, all
that's
of
not
the,
ignorance.
No, that's my point. All of the steps you have to do to go through that, you might be ignorant on the historical aspects of blackface, but you weren't ignorant about, you know, you weren't uninformed about, oh, this might be insensitive to somebody. You just decided that, you know, oh, it's gonna be funny. My friends are this. You didn't care. And to me, that's just inexcusable.
It's just ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Now, what about so
there was one thing that came up, and I was like, I actually don't. I for real, I have been thinking about this for 2 days now, and I don't even know. I don't even know how to feel about it. So Iggy Azalea, in case everybody didn't know, had this big beef with Snoop Dogg, and in the midst of this beef with him, Snoop Dogg said that she looked like Sean Wayans' character in the movie White Girls. So Iggy decided to go as one of the characters from White Girls with one of her friends for Halloween this year. So she put extra white stuff on her face. She put a big...
she basically did white face.
Broad nose on, and she had the... I mean, she did the whole outfit and everything and looked like one of the girls from White Girls. And
it looked like she had a professional makeup crew. It looked
no,
like,
obviously. She's a star, performer, yeah. Of course.
But I guess my point is, it was a convincing costume.
Yeah, but I'm, like, confused. Her costume is of a black guy playing a white girl, but she's white. So I don't know what that is.
It's like Tropic Thunder.
It is like
I'm
Tropic
the dude
Thunder.
Playing the dude.
I'm
that's
the
playing
dude.
The dude that's
playing
the
dude.
Dude
that thinks he's playing a dude. No, it's I'm so confused. I don't even know how to feel about it, much less what to call it. It's what it is fucking genius.
Well, I like that it's as a sly
because she
slap
had literally,
to Snoop. It's brilliant.
It's a great slap to Snoop, and she also almost was she got away with doing blackface.
Is it blackface?
Well, is it or is it not? But she's playing a black guy. It's very slick. She's
playing
smart.
A black guy playing a white
That's
girl.
What I'm saying.
It's a white girl playing a black guy
playing a white
girl.
It's very, very...
Meta. I don't hate it. I don't know why.
Well,
I
she pulled it off, number one. You know, I'm not the biggest Iggy Azalea fan, but she did pull the costume off.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say about it,
you know,
except for that it's pretty brilliant
I said
on
this,
her part.
We talked about this the other night. in regards to, and we'll get into this later on the episode about SNL, but if it's funny, right? If you're funny at the root of it, you can get away with a lot more shit.
I think without the Snoop Dogg tie-in, it wouldn't be nearly as effective. Because he had already called her this, I feel like it's more like she almost is like, well, here's my answer.
Like she's above it.
Yeah. So that's why I feel like I look like this chick from White
Girls? Right.
If she just happened to be like, I'm going to be the black guy from White Girls dressed up as a white girl, I'd be like, why? That's so random and you're already white.
You would have read and interpreted more into it.
Exactly.
Because it's a vacuum. You don't know.
Correct.
Well, in the same sense, the iFlood panties, perhaps, there isn't an attempt to be humor at all.
No.
It's not humor.
And that's
There's
my
no
point. That's
all.
Why it's like, what was your point exactly? And why did you think that Edward was somebody that needed to be dressed up as whatever?
I hear you. I'm not going to beef with whoever dressed up as that.
I'm not beefing with anybody. It's a freaking Halloween costume. In the end, you know, you're a racist. You're going to be a racist the whole year. You just put it on blast on Halloween. That's all I'm saying.
Well, and white people, just stop it with
just
the
stop,
face.
Man. Just stop. You got enough.
Stop.
Why don't you be some white people? There's a lot of you. Be all of them.
Yeah. Well, is there any other costumes?
No, those were the only ones that I wanted to discuss.
You know, if you're listening, I just love like cats and dogs in costumes.
What? Oh, you love cats and dogs in costumes?
I do. I didn't see enough on Halloween. I sent out a couple, but
there were a few.
You can send them my way.
I like baby costumes.
Like babies. Okay.
Yeah, because I think they're funny. They always dress them as like peas or like.
See, I always feel like dogs have like borderline like human looking faces.
But the dogs look so upset.
No,
the cats look like they're about to scratch your eyes out.
Well, and the style of dog costume where they put the dog's face through like a human's head, and there's like fake arms, and then the dog's legs are the human's legs.
Right.
Those kill me. Yeah. They just make me laugh.
It's funny.
So moving on, I guess maybe back to maybe slightly heavier things. Mike Tyson was in the news again, and he opened up about sexual abuse on a radio show. And I'll just play the clip here.
Yep.
People can't take it with people keeping you're great. And you know you're a poverty stricken guy living in a condemned building with your family, begging for money and food with your family. And they don't see that, but it's wow, they don't know about this. I'm not great. They don't know these guys bullied me and sexually abused me and stuff. If I told them that, they'd think, oh, you fucking bully this or that. You know, you have these, you say, wow, these people don't know me. And you just know, you want your, the only thing that bothers you, want your demons, you don't know. It's just really crazy, sick. This is a dangerous neighborhood to travel by yourself.
How old were you when someone sexually abused you?
I was a little kid, seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
And the person was, were they your age or they were like an old man?
Old man, yeah.
Old man?
Yeah.
Was it one time or ongoing?
No, one time.
Did you ever get him back?
No. Never seen him again.
Oh, it was just one of those random passerby things.
Snatched me off the street.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. You were walking and he just grabbed you?
Yeah.
And did he, besides he abused you and then just let you go, or did you escape?
Well, I ran.
I'll stop there. I don't know if you saw it, Lizzie. It's Jim Norton and Opie on because Opie and Andy got canceled, so it's Opie and Jim Norton.
Oh, okay.
And Jim Norton was almost kind of, I don't want to say incredulous, but his, even though he was questioning it, I thought it was kind of a little bit strange. I don't know. This is a little bit of a trigger for me. I don't like always talking about stuff. You know, I go pretty, in terms of my, you know, if I, in terms of abuse and kids, that just, oh, my God.
I think that's true, of course. I think it's true for a lot of people. But I think the thing about it is hearing Mike talk about it. You know, he's such a tragic figure in my mind.
Well, and that's kind of what I was thinking so much.
He's been so, you know, used, discarded.
Chewed up and spit out.
Chewed up and spit out. And what's left is this, like, you know, almost, oh, you know, in Harry Potter, when at the very, very end, that the way that they kill Voldemort is they find his like little shriveled up, like, you know, hurt little tiny piece of him, you know,
right,
of Voldemort. And it's like the, you know, the hurt, the pain, all of it in one place. Like, I feel like that's all that's left of Mike Tyson. And it's like sad to me to see somebody that had so much promise and so many things that could have happened to his life, despite all of the hardships that he faced early on.
Well, and
that so many people took advantage of him.
Exactly,
it's just a testament to the, you know, disgusting sometimes human nature of people and how they can, you know, always turn things to their advantage.
Sure, and just that abuse the cycle of abuse, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that that's always the case, but, you know, he's a convicted, you know, rapist, and we should, you know, not whitewash that, right?
No, Desiree definitely not. I'm not
Robin
making
Givens.
That's my point. My point is that you abuse, you're abused over and over again. So all that's left is rage.
Well,
rage manifests itself in abuse.
And look at his life, too. Like, it, you know, so now we know it started at he had some, you know, he's abused sexually at 7. At 16, he's orphan, basically. His mom and dad have both passed away. He's with Custom Auto, and then he's the heavyweight champion at 20. You know, 20, the unified, whatever, tri-belt champion. It's like a, you know, the world's at his oyster. He's dropped out of high school. He's reliant on all sorts of other people. And you can just see the entire arc of his career, including that conviction. Even now, to some degree, you know, his attempts at comeback. I don't know if you remember, but he had those, I think he was trying to be more, like, comedic. He didn't quite know if he was going to be able to do something with the sort of hangover, and he's broke, and he's trying to make a living. But he made on a radio show some comments about Sarah Palin, and, like, she should be, you know, fucked by, like, a, you know, big dick black guy to fuck her brains out, like, really inappropriate shit.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was maybe him trying to figure out sort of his comedy and what he can do with it. But I just, the whole thing about his life's kind of, I don't want to say it's sad, but remember when he lost the last boxing fight we ever saw was Lennox Lewis, the pay-per-view.
Right.
And he got just the crappy out of him. Like, left side of his head was like a giant, like, golf ball on the
top, like,
of his head.
People had memes where it was talking and stuff.
But he after that, he was like, I just want to fade to oblivion.
You know, I think he said Bolivian.
But he's like, I just want to, you know, be
fade
with my pigeons.
Fade into Bolivian and be with my pigeons.
Yeah.
And I thought it was
sad.
Such a sad statement. I'm just like, look, he just doesn't even, he wants to check out.
Well, listen to these other quotes. In 2000, he said, my brother was always something and I was nothing.
Mm.
And then an interview with USA Today published again in 2005, my whole life has been a waste. I've been a failure. I just want to escape. I'm really embarrassed with myself and my life. I want to be a missionary. I think I could do that while keeping my dignity without letting people know they chased me out of the country.
Mm.
I want to get this part of my life over as soon as possible. In this country, nothing good is going to come out of me. People put me so high. I want to tear that image down.
Mm.
And I feel like he's being, in order for him to be comfortable enough to say that on the radio, he clearly is in a bit of a different place.
Yeah.
He's more comfortable, more real. You know, I think we're getting, and I think that's what people are identifying with.
Yeah, and the responding
whole,
to.
Well, and the whole redemption. People love to tear
people,
you down
we
and
do
then
love the
see
redemption
you climb
tale.
Back up.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. I felt bad for him. But so he's got a new thing he's doing, the Mike Tyson Mysteries.
Yes, and, it's like Scooby-Doo, but
yeah, it's on Adult
Tyson.
Swim. But I'll just read you a little bit of text. So Jackson 5 and the Harlem Globetrotters before him, Mike Tyson has crossed a key threshold of popular iconography. He has his own cartoon, Mike Tyson Mysteries, evoking the look, feel, and political incorrectness of 1970s-era Saturday morning animation. The show has Tyson solving crimes with the Marquise of Queensberry's ghost, Tyson's Korean daughter, and a pigeon voiced by Norm MacDonald.
Who's so obnoxiously, horrible. It's hilarious.
That might be the weirdest fucking premise for a cartoon.
And the Marquise
ever.
Is super gay, and he's, the one that got Tyson to, turn his life around in the history of it. And then the Korean daughter was just left on his doorstep.
In the cartoon.
Yes.
Not in real life.
No, I mean, he has actual children.
He's got, like,
with his wife.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that's the premise of it. And they have a van, they go in, and Mike has absolutely no idea what he's doing. He always wants to do the most ridiculous thing. The first episode I watched featured the mystery they were trying to solve was how to finish the most recent Cormac MacArthur novel, because Cormac couldn't finish it himself. I'm not joking.
Do you remember when we read On the Road? Is that what it was?
No, we read
The Road.
The Road, yeah.
And we got to the end, we're like,
that's it?
Fuck, are you kidding me? That's terrible. Not to spoiler alert that book, but...
No, don't say anything about the book.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil it. Just the end was like, what? So he had an interview in Sports Illustrated, of all places, and the guy says, your character's pretty ditzy. Is he meant to be a parody of your public image? And Tyson says, no, it's really me. I'm a horrible driver, and there's a scene where I'm sucking as a driver, picking up Buzz Aldrin, so they use things like that. It's my real personality away from the cameras. And he says, you've been doing comedy a decade. Was this the plan? He says, no, I never thought I was funny, but I did that one-man show, and it was called... Undisputed Truth. I was spilling my guts and horrific things in my life, and people were laughing. So he started adding jokes and ad-libbing, and now it's considered a stand-up act.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting.
It is funny, though.
I haven't seen it.
I've seen it. Spike Lee directed a version of it for HBO.
Right.
And it was funny. It was a little weird because there are some mixed media parts. He talks about when his daughter was killed and everything. But he's funny. His timing is very good. And in the cartoon, he's very funny.
Really? So I have the mysteries.
He sings a bunch. It's
I have the cartoons
funny.
Promo, but are we running long? You want to play the promo or not?
Let me see. Where are we?
It's a couple minutes.
Yeah, No, let's not do it.
Okay.
No.
It starts with him and his pigeons, and he says, "Each one of these has a message to be solved."
It's true. Each one does. Yeah. Love Norm it. MacDonald wasn't always a pigeon. He was turned into one, just FYI.
Oh, Norm MacDonald's a pigeon. Okay.
Yes. He's one of the pigeons. He's just called Pigeon. Yeah. That's
he's just
name.
Called Pigeon.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But he's a total asshole and a womanizer, and it's funny as hell. Well, and they swear. So
speaking
funny.
Of total assholes and womanizers, I hate to go right into just more bullshit.
Are you talking about frat guys?
I'm talking about frat guys.
Of course we are. We need a sound effect for frat guy news because it seems like we've had 10 episodes. I think we've talked about asshole frat guys like half the shows. Go on. Let's hear it. I haven't heard anything about this.
Oh, my God. And you just get your fucking seatbelt and your puke bucket because it's fucking horrible. I'm serious, man. I spotted it. It came out like recently, this lawsuit.
Right.
And I tagged, we like, oh, let's talk about this in the podcast.
Right, right. We have like little notes we keep.
Yeah, I tagged it and I had read the CNN sort of like, and I hate CNN, but I'd read their little bit. And then I started digging a little bit deeper and I had to actually like click like three or four things to get the actual letters written, which I will read in its entirety, shamefully as it is. The whole time I'm going through it, I'm like, this is fucking disgusting. I knew we were going to talk about it. I'm like, it's way worse than I thought it was.
Oh, boy.
So, again, be prepared.
Okay.
So, a lawsuit's been filed against the Phi Kappa Tau fraternity. Georgia Tech fraternity brother Matthew Peterson had sent a sexual how-to rape letter, I guess, kind of. Okay. I'm serious. To all of his little frat brothers. Mm-hmm. But so they're suing because there's actually been two sexual assaults at this university involving, I think, the same suspect, but two separate sexual assaults over a period of years. And the lawsuit now with this letter in hand is arguing, I think they're going to be successful, that the adults, the people in charge, not just the campus, but the actual chapter had a place that allowed this sort of culture of misogyny and fucking rape. But let's I have a sound bit. I'll play this first.
Stay against a fraternity advisor and fraternity accused of creating a culture that encouraged rape. B.J. Bernstein represents two women who say they were plied with alcohol and raped in the Phi Kappa Tau house on Georgia Tech's campus.
Fraternity and the fraternity advisor, all those adults, all those people who are watching that fraternity were asleep at the wheel.
This is the same fraternity where the social chair was accused of sending out an instructional email titled Luring Your Rape Bait. Bernstein says God. It was all recorded in meeting minutes. She also says the frat
recorded in meeting minutes.
A vigil for rape victims as a place to pick up girls.
Christ
there was
almighty.
A special thing on campus to protect women who have been
horrible.
Victims of sexual violence, suggesting that would be a good place to go and get rape bait.
I just want to make sure you're clear. There was a vigil for victims of sexual assault, and they recommend picking up women at a vigil for sexual assault.
These people are going to hell.
There's a little bit more.
Stunningly bad.
In a statement, the fraternity wrote that they were disappointed that the plaintiffs, quote, chose to exploit the hypersensitivity of today's college environment.
Hypersensitivity.
By drafting the complaints in a manner that sensationalizes completely inappropriate statements. Bernstein says the frat also sang traditional songs at Christmas that included lyrics about violence against women. She says this is just the start.
We'll go through this process of digging and finding out more and getting people under oath to really tell the truth.
It's absolutely fucking disgusting.
Oh, my God. First of all, that statement is almost as offensive. It's just like what I was saying about Missouri State the other day. That's like, you're the fucking organization, and this is your response?
Here's the plaintiff's attorney, Simon, when his response is, we're disappointed that plaintiff's attorney chose to exploit the hypersensitivity of today's college environment towards sexual assault.
How about you be fucking disappointed that these men were writing a textbook on how to rape women? How about you be disappointed about that?
You gotta hear a response. So they're disappointed in the hypersensitivity. She says, well, I totally agree that the language is salacious. It's the words of their own members. Literally. It's just absolutely fucking...
The language isn't salacious. The behavior is.
Well, so here's the letter. It's absolutely insanity. And like I said, I had to dig a little bit.
You're going to read the whole thing?
It's, you know... Well, I suppose I... It's not out a lot of places, but...
you don't have to read it. I really...
Georgia
I don't
Tech
even...
fraternity brother Matthew Peterson. I'd like his name to be known. Matthew Peterson. It's really... It's so ridiculous... Maybe I shouldn't read it, but it's like if they're hammered before midnight, skip the chit chat, go to the dance. He's talking like to basically, it's almost like he read or got one of these fucked up like how to pick up women books, and he's trying to distill that for his less socially adept brothers. Like I don't know if the Phi Kappa fraternity got like a bunch of weirdos in, but it was such a bunch of rapists. No, but like a minute-by-minute, like, how-to fucking guide. Like, here's how to dance. Grab them on the hips with your two hands and then let them grind against your dick. After that, slowly alternate between just putting your hand across their stomach, but make sure you don't go too high. Keep it under the boob. Or too low. Don't try to finger her yet. Literally. That's fucking verbatim.
Okay, don't read anymore. Please. I can't. I don't want it on our podcast.
You don't want this letter on our podcast?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Well, it's... So disgusting.
Because you never know who could listen to it. You said it was hard to find. It should be fucking hard to find. I don't want to even put any of it out there. It's disgusting.
I just don't understand. I guess I do. I'm starting to realize, right? I had a little bit of awakening with the UOK Sis movement and the video that, you know, I was unaware of the propensity. This is just fucking disgusting.
Disgusting.
Like, I know rape culture is like kind of ridiculous, like really ridiculous, but... Fuck, that they wrote fucking minutes and had a fucking meeting. And they fucking labeled it fucking rape bait. In luring rape bait. Like, literally, that's his fucking tagline. Like, salutations in luring rape bait. Like, really? I just... That's unfathomable to me. Unfathomable to me. I just... I don't know where to even begin.
Nor I. Let's skip the tree harassment.
You don't even want to... You're that upset?
Nope, I don't want to talk about it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be talking about it Friday with Lady J, so.
Really? You're that upset? You just want to skip it?
Yep.
Okay. Skipped.
Skipped. All right. So.
Speaking of privilege.
Speaking of privilege. Something came across my purview this week. I think it was Friday. It's a photo, Miss Kylie Jenner, one youngest.
Remind me, which one's Kylie?
She's the youngest.
She's the model or no?
No, she's the youngest.
Kendall's
one.
The model, okay.
Kylie Jenner, sister of Kim Kardashian.
Is she the one that just had the face different?
I don't know what she had. Does it matter? It has nothing to do with what
I don't know which one's
about.
Which, but
well,
okay.
Who cares?
I do.
Why?
Because I don't know them.
It was the other one. Does it change what I'm going to say?
Maybe.
How?
I don't know, but now I know.
Okay. Anyways, it's the youngest one. And she's the daughter of Kris Jenner and Bruce Jenner, and she is the youngest of the Nae Kardashian K-girls, whoever they are, whatever. So she posted on Instagram, oh, about time I got my nails done, showing off her manicure. No problem there. Only I looked down at her wrist. She has 6 bracelets on. Not just any bracelets, my friends. But a $6,600 a piece Cartier love bracelet in yellow gold.
Each one, $6,000?
Each one.
And she's got 6 of them on.
$6,600 each. She has 6 of them on her arm. And this is not even the point of the photo. This is the other thing I want to make sure, that she has almost $40,000 worth of jewelry on her arm, and the picture is about her nail.
But is she a, she's like a Cartier, like she does shit for him, right? Like she
gets- no.
So this isn't even like a...
That's just what she decided to put
like
on that day.
It wasn't like an Instagram...
That's
like,
what she wore to the nail salon.
And she's not a Cartier model or a Cartier spokesperson at all.
Nope.
It was just a Tuesday.
It was just a, woo, these bracelets are cool. I'm going to get 6 of them and put them all on.
40 Gs.
And wear them to the nail salon.
And the picture wasn't even about the
bracelets. No, you can see the bracelets are like not even in focus at the bottom of the frame. It's about her nails. Her nails look good, by the way. I love good nails. It's a great nail polish.
If you got $40,000 on your hand, I'm sure you spent $100 on the nails.
But for real? So I saw this in conjunction with a tweet from Howard University about how they were really looking at keeping the cost of tuition there low to make it more affordable and increase potential for financial aid to come to the school. And so I did a little research there. So 1 year, including tuition, room, board at Howard University costs $38,767.
Less than the bangles on her.
And wrist. In her photo, Miss Kylie Jenner, who is not even 18, she is a 17-year-old young lady, has $39,600 worth of merchandise on her hand. Just some food for thought there, people. It's a whole year. A whole year.
Are you shocked
of higher education?
That they're rich as shit? That doesn't surprise me.
No, it's not. Yes, I know that they're rich as shit, but it's rare that you have such a direct visual comparison to make. That on this girl's, this 17-year-old girl's arm is a year of tuition to one of the best universities in our country.
Yeah.
You don't get that often. On her arm. I don't even know what she was wearing, because I'm sure there's a hell of a lot more money there. I don't know what she had on her ears. I don't know what she had on her neck. I'm just talking about one arm.
Yeah.
One arm.
I see it with those bags, that fucking Birkin bag. I'm like, God, that thing's got like two cars right there.
Good Lord. You're
just throwing your fucking iPhone in it. Jesus.
Yeah. Anyways. Just wanted to mention that.
That's a lot. $39,000.
It's kind
of crazy.
It's messed up, man.
And she's not even out of high school yet.
Nope.
17.
Nope.
All right.
And let me just say this. Two things came to my head. One is that she probably didn't even pay for them at all. They probably were just given to her.
Probably.
But if they weren't, she actually makes enough money she can afford to buy them herself.
Of course.
At 17.
Why
with a
she?
Beauty line and a swimsuit line and whatever the hell else she gets while she gets paid to be on those crappy shows. It's kind of crazy. And there's students going into Hawk for the rest of their lives to pay for their education, and she's wearing on her wrist.
Yeah.
Something's wrong here, man.
Opportunity hoarding.
Something is wrong.
That was that whole that we talked about AUA in our podcast.
About rich kids doing everything wrong and still coming out on top.
And poor kids that do everything right.
This is a direct view of this. Yeah. She could literally drop out of high school right now. She's still going to be wearing $40,000 worth of jewelry on her arm.
Yeah.
Okay, anyways. So track the trailer. Let's track the trailer.
Track the trailer!
I got it. So we did Birdman, right? So we watched Birdman, the movie. Is that your Birdman sound?
That's my Birdman sound.
Why don't we just... rather than describe Track the Trailer, we got to rename it Edge of Tomorrow. Wasn't it the Tom Cruise movie now? It's got a new name.
Yeah, well, that was just like in DVD, though.
Well, but the movie came out called Edge of Tomorrow.
Right.
And then when they released the DVD, they're calling it Die, Rise, Die Again. What's it called?
Live, Die, Repeat.
Live, Die, Repeat. Because Edge of Tomorrow was such a bit of a failure. But anyway, so here's our discussion of what we thought.
The tagline was The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
This movie looks awesome.
I love Michael Keaton. I love Edward Norton. I love Zach Galifianakis.
I love that, like, he was Batman.
Yeah.
So there is, like, a meta kind of, like, and he did say no to Batman 3 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
He did two. He did the first two with Tim Burton. I think it, well, to me, I mean, obviously, I think it's going to be about kind of sort of some sort of redemption tale for this washed up superhero actor.
A character study.
But I also, just visually looking at it, it seems like it's going to be slightly surreal, and it looked like a lot of one takes to me.
And back to that surreal bit, I'm not sure if I'm interpreting this correctly, but there was a couple of pieces where I don't know if he's going to actually have some sort of supernatural powers or believe he has supernatural powers, because there were some scenes that he was like floating above the table. There's the bit where he snaps his fingers and the bolts of lightning come down, and are you filming a movie? Is this real? So I don't know if that's going to be in his head or if he's really going to have some sort of capabilities. I'm not sure.
I don't think he's going to have capabilities. I think it's grounded in reality in terms of the world that it's in. That's just my impression from the preview. But I do think that...
Well, he's not grounded fully in reality.
That's what I mean by surreal. I think there's going to be some, you know, flights of fancy. And it's definitely clearly from this character's POV, seems to be.
Sure.
And it's got Emma Stone in it, Naomi Watts, Zach Galifianakis. It looks really good.
And I don't mean to poo-poo PG-13 movies, but I like that this is rated R.
Yeah,
I think that gives him some. And is it wide release or is only a few?
It's an independent movie, so it's in wide release right now. Yeah, is in wide release right now.
Okay.
I think it's wider than Dear White People.
And the trailer gave me almost like, I think surreal is the right word, but like, Kaufman-esque, like we talked about Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah, definitely that feeling. That's why I said it looked like a lot of one takes, like the camera was following the characters, not that it was a static shot, which you don't see that much. Certainly, it almost looked like every shot was like that. It's interesting, so we'll see.
And I love that the dynamic that they're talking about is this character that played Birdman and that Keaton really did play Batman. And really, I'm not saying Keaton's at all washed up. I don't think that at all. I think he's a terrific actor.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
He hasn't done anything in a long time.
No, but so I also think he's one of those people like he doesn't have to, and I respect the fact that he's been like, I don't need to do anything. I'm rich. What fuck do I need to do anything for you for?
And I don't know if you noticed, but I really like that, and I think you see this more with female actors. But it doesn't look like he's having the Botox and the work.
No,
like,
he's aged. And but he looks good.
He looks good. He's aged well.
He looks really good. Yeah, for sure.
So we're gonna see this this weekend.
I will stop it there. But we were pretty spot on.
We were pretty good, actually. I think it definitely was delivered on what we expected it to be.
All one takes, now, like you said.
Total, like, plethora of one takes. Lots of one takes.
No, I think the whole movie.
Yeah, the whole movie seemed like
you could see where they would do...
Like, they'd stop, and then they'd move to a second one take. Yeah,
but they would do it so effectively that it didn't seem like it was a break.
Yeah, it's very, very, very good direction in that regard on cinematography. I don't know if I would recommend it.
It was definitely a character study, right?
Yeah, and I don't know how effective it was.
Well, and I said to somebody today, I was talking about it at church, and I said that the ending was, you know, very ambiguous. It left the viewer with sort of this like,
you didn't know what happened.
And I would have preferred if they'd not made it ambiguous. They made a decision.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
Agreed. But the trailer, as far as the trailer part of things, very accurate. Yeah. It definitely was a redemption tale about this washed up guy and kind of flights of fancy, surrealist take on his life. Although, and you found there were a lot of backstage, you know, antics of putting on a play and Broadway acting and that kind of thing, too.
Well, I thought that maybe somewhere that the trailer didn't present, and I don't know if it was deliberate, there were a lot of comedy bits delivered by Ed Norton.
No, there was a lot of funny, hilarious. There were a lot of laughs, and you're right. They didn't make it any clear at all there were going to be any, and there was not just a few, but like the whole theater raucously laughing out loud. Like,
well, I think Ed Norton's character is the comic foil for the whole character in the movie and the arc.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about it. There was right at the beginning on his mirror when he's in the dressing room.
Right.
It said, the thing is the thing, not what people say about the thing.
Right.
Not what people write about the thing.
Right.
And I feel like that's a bit of an allegory for the movie and the character and sort of how he develops. And I think that's accurate, but you know, I would maybe recommend it on DVD.
I don't think you have to go see it in the theater.
It was good.
It was well acted, I'll say that for sure. And the cinematography was very good. I thought that the story could have been a little tighter, and I didn't particularly care for the ending. So that's what I would say about it.
One, when you do these character studies, they either have to be very, very good or very, very redeeming characters.
Right.
Or something about the character that
makes
you want
to watch it. I thought the character was redeeming, and I did like watching. I thought that the character was very interesting, and I was very vested. So I think they did a good job with that. I just don't think they drove it home for me.
Yeah. It was good, though.
They didn't quite get it
to
the
front.
I enjoyed it. It was a good night at the movies.
Yeah. It was certainly better than handing out candy.
Well, yeah, for sure that. Grubby little kids. So let's move on to the latter part of our show. We usually talk about some TV stuff. So we don't actually usually even watch Saturday Night Live, but Chris Rock was on this week. And so...
And Prince.
So we decided to, you know, tape it. Well, I did because you incorrectly taped it again. But anyways, I did get it taped. And
which is a shame because it was horrible.
It was so bad. I mean, I know last week we talked literally the title of the episode last week was
funny.
Jim Carrey's Not Funny.
And exhibit A was his SNL.
And it was exactly.
Episode. Yeah.
It was bad.
So, and I'm bored. We're behind maybe like 20, 30 minutes so we can fast forward the commercials. So I'm sort of live tweeting SNL a little bit. And I remember people were, you know, pumped about Prince's performance. And he did one instead of breaking up into
two. Right. He only agreed to do it if he could do an 8-minute full performance versus breaking it up.
A couple of songs. But so
including an Alice Smith cover. Shout out to Alice Smith. If you guys do not know who she is, you are missing out. She is literally a powerhouse vocalist, and her albums are amazing. And if you have the opportunity to see her live anywhere, do it.
And she's at least here in Philly, like small venues. It wasn't a big theater. It was nice to see her.
Yeah, and she's almost on tour, like if she's not recording an album, she's on tour.
Well, so back to SNL, I'm literally in the middle of it being like, oh, this is so fucking terrible. This is two episodes in a row. And a lot of like big tweeters are kind of saying the same thing, like, ah, oh, SNL is horrible. And I don't know who started it. I thought maybe Jamie Blackerlones, but I don't, maybe that's incorrect. But pretty quickly and pretty organically, and not just small, but like trending worldwide, or at least in the U.S., things funnier than SNL hashtag.
Yep.
It was just like, it went
quick. Of course.
Quick,
Twitter
quick.
Had
love Twitter.
Trying.
And I a couple that I thought were just spot on, like, this hashtag, things funny in SNL, is funny in SNL. So they went a couple different routes. One was sort of like this actual dull stuff, like Lifetime movies, Hallmark movie of the week,
right.
Standing
in line. I felt like
DMV.
There were different types. It was like ones that were being like ironic, where it was like, this shit's horrible and it's still funnier than this. And
right.
Then it was ones that were like, let me just pull out some like funny stuff that's
Lately, I feel like Twitter with the hashtag, at some point, there's a little bit of this sort of like activism thread that goes through it.
Right.
Where they're using the hashtag to make a sort of almost ironic comparison between things. And there's a good many of those that I really liked. So like the male ego is funnier than SNL. Watching Fox News.
Funnier than SNL.
Yeah. That one black Power Ranger. Funny than SNL. It actually is the best quote. This person said, Prince didn't even come out for the farewell. He saw the brand of bullshit SNL was on and rode off on a unicorn in a puff of purple smoke.
With the three-eyed sunglasses.
I tweeted about those three-eyed sunglasses. And before
listen,
I even said
before
it,
you started, he's like, I'm tweeting about Prince. I said, listen, you better
you
slow
did,
your roll.
You did,
people
you
will come for you talking about
you
Prince.
Did,
although I'm
did.
About to talk about Prince, so.
Well, but so I thought the three-eyed like sunglasses were just weird, these little mirrors. And I tweeted that, like, for a minute, I was like, is this a bit or is this like Prince? I can't really tell. And you said, oh, oh, you're not. And I love Prince. I do. I really do. He's a great musician. I love him. I love him. Love him. And I tweeted it. And somebody Ray was like, I do not like the tone you're taking with Prince right now, very white guy. Like, instantly. Like, the retweet was immediately like, I do not like your tone about Prince. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I really am. He's an awesome musician. I just was a little confused by the set for a minute.
Yeah, I actually was disappointed in his performance. I know you said you thought it was good. I
thought he was good.
I didn't think he was good. You know, my problem with Prince is like, when you're a young man, you can surround yourself with beautiful women who are your muses and you collaborate with them. And he's had a long line of them, from Carmen Electra to Vanity, Apollonia, Mai Tai, Wendy and Lisa, Sheila E. Apparently now Leanne LaHavas is on the list. She was the singer that was performing in
right.
the very first song with him before he did the Alice Smith cover, which was a cover of Alice Smith, which is a whole other thing I'll mention in a second. But I don't know. I just think as he's gotten older, it comes off like kind of gross.
Really?
And a little.
What are older rockers supposed to do?
I don't know what they're supposed to do, but it doesn't come off the same way as it used to. Like, when you're the same age as the performers you're performing with, and it's like, oh, I've got these two awesome female guitarists, and we're jamming it out here, and it's awesome, and the revolution. Last night, it didn't come off that way.
It came off kind of creepy. I feel like what you're talking about, I feel that with Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. I don't necessarily feel that about Prince yet. Maybe
yeah,
that's just me.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't.
Because Steven Tyler looks and is probably, are they contemporaries? They got to be pretty close to the same age.
Maybe
Tyler's older.
I think Tyler might be older. But I just, something about it, it was like.
Well, where's it? What's a person who's that age that's doing it differently? That isn't doing the rock thing with girls and.
I don't know. I just feel like if the point was like, oh, I've got this cool all-girl band, like it didn't come off as an empowering thing. Whereas when you would watch The Revolution with Wendy and Lisa, it did. Like, those chicks were hard and badass, and it didn't come off that way last night. Those women didn't look like that. Hmm. They looked like stage dressing for him. And that's not how it used to be with Prince.
Interesting.
And so,
but it was, it's the same.
It fell a little flat for me.
Nothing's changed
that.
Other than his age.
I don't know if that's true. They just seemed faceless, nameless, you know. There wasn't a lot of individuality there, whereas when it was with The Revolution or Sheena Easton or Sheila E., like, it was about the individuality of these women that he was interacting with and their chemistry together. He didn't even interact with them. You used to see him when he had the New Power Generation was after the revolution, and he had the lead singer, Rosie, older black woman, and he would always be like playing in front of her while she was singing, and it was a lot of back and forth, and this wasn't that at all. They were doing their thing that they had been instructed to do, and then he was being Prince. And it just fell a little flat for me. And I also wish sometimes he would just sing. Like, I don't need all of that theatrics.
Well, and I guess for me,
you're one of the most amazing musicians walking the planet today. Like, why do you need all of that?
Yeah, but that's, to me, it's, on some level, it's like, that's how it always is. That's just the production that people put out, and it's always been gloss and staged.
Staged with the music still being high quality. And I don't know if I would agree with that performance last night being that. I thought his cover of the Alice Smith song was woefully inferior to the original. Just putting that out there.
Did he write the original?
He did not. Alice did. It was an actual cover of her song. He has it on his
album. You said there was a controversy with it.
The controversy is that Alice participated in a tribute to Prince at Carnegie Hall last year. And she performed with a band. And they did Prince's song, Pop Life. And several videos of the performances were online, including this one that Alice Smith did, this cover. And Prince had his record label pull it off of YouTube because he didn't want her cover of his song on YouTube.
Were there other covers on YouTube that he didn't pull off?
I don't know, but I think it's kind of ballsy for you to take someone's cover of your music off YouTube and then put their song on your fucking album and then play it on SNL. Obviously, he's paying Alice Smith for using her song and recording it and all of that. I'm not saying that there isn't money changing hands, but I just think morally and like, I don't know.
That's assuming he did that personally. He's got lawyers and people and shit. They have a policy. Prince, YouTube, letter.
He can do whatever the hell he wants to.
I know. I'm just saying. And I'm not going to go as far as to say he knew that this was an issue. I don't know.
There were multiple articles written about this situation.
About Alice Smith.
Yes, because the people that posted the link to it are the Three Eyed Band, which are the three nameless, faceless girls that were playing with him last night. And they posted a link to this YouTube video of Alice performing it. And then the record company pulled it down. Their record company and his record company that he owns. I'll just leave it there. I just would say... I will hope for more. If you're going to take 8 minutes of this shitty SNL show that I really was only watching because he was on it.
That was the only redeeming 8 minutes the whole fucking show.
And it wasn't that redeeming is my point.
I think
maybe you thought it was better than it was because it was next to such
crap. Yeah, I was going
to
say that and when I say it was bad, like there was, and I forget the skit, it was so forgettable, but there was a moment where the new, the girl that was a writer that she's now
Leslie,
on the show.
Her name is Leslie.
She walked off stage.
She missed her cue.
Back on stage.
Yeah, she missed her cue.
Looked at like each camera.
Listen, it happens.
Put her hands up.
I don't think it needs to be. I mean, we've watched many Saturday Night Live where people miss a cue.
The whole thing.
And it's weird.
But there's even the ISIS skit on
the ISIS skit just didn't have a point.
It was in poor taste. It was
the only funny skit they had was the one with all the black people supporting Barack Obama. I actually thought that was funny.
Well, that's because it's Keenan. He's still can.
He's so. And this is his last year. They're going to miss him, man. I was talking. Rod from the Blackout Tips was talking about today, like how missed he's going to be because. Honestly, he's like, to me, he's like the new Daryl Hammond. He's always professional, always hits his mark, always knows his lines, he never breaks. He's so good at what
for
he
real,
does.
Y'all, we had that, what's up with that? His little dance.
What's up with that? Honestly,
on the DVR for like 5 years.
I watch that shit right motherfucking
Ooh-wee.
Now.
What's up with that?
What's up with that? Oh my gosh, so funny. Okay.
Ooh-wee.
What's up with that? What's up?
Well, I was telling you, and I know you haven't been a big fan of the show, but
nope.
I'm starting to lose steam on How to Get Away with Murder.
Mm.
I liked the kind of formulaic 20, Law and Order kind of stuff.
I think it jumps around too goddamn much. That's my first problem with it. Like, come on.
I can't tweet. I got to watch it.
It's like too much, like, oh, 2 weeks ago, 7 months ago, this guy's dead. He's not dead now. Wait, he's still alive. What the hell's going on? I never even know what I'm watching on the show. And it has, like, flashbacks of flashbacks. It's too goddamn much.
Here's the real deal for me. And I think Shonda's other shows... You get some character invest. You get invested in characters in a pretty significant way. I'm just not invested in kind of anybody. Like, kind of Viola's character, but...
She's, like, the only one you would be invested in. Honestly, every one of those... Every single one of those law students is horrible.
I don't give a
shit. The black kid's the worst one. I don't even know what his real name is. He's horrible. People have been comparing him to the black Ken doll. They say he looks like the black Ken doll.
Really?
I just find him completely, like... If a black guy could be... What's that word? Milquetoast?
Milquetoast?
Yeah, that's him, dude.
Well, and I
mean, he seems like he like shits chalk. Like he's like completely devoid of personality. Completely
well,
devoid.
I'll be honest.
Wonder what the person, the actual actor, is he that bland in real life? Are they asking him to play that bland? Like, I'm really trying to figure it out because it's confusing to me. I haven't seen anybody on this show on any talk shows or anything besides Viola, which I find weird. Mm. Even in Grey's Anatomy's first season, you saw Sandra Oh, you saw Patrick Dempsey, you saw a lot of people from the ensemble, even people you didn't know that well. Chandra Wilson, for example.
Right.
She wasn't really a brand name actor until this show, but she was still going on talk shows, maybe not top tier, but maybe she'd go on Seth Meyers or Craig Ferguson, you know? But none of these people have done any press. What are they, hiding them?
Well, I'll keep watching. I'll watch the first season.
It's weird.
It's been done, but I'm losing a little bit of
Yeah, it's weird. And then the other last show we want to talk about was Parenthood, which is ending so soon. We're coming the last 10 episodes of the show. I'm so happy that the NBC stuck by Jason Katamis and gave them this last season to not necessarily wrap these stories up because it's about a family and families
like
don't end,
kind of
but certainly
ways.
Give us some time to say goodbye to them.
Not that we're talking about, but I hate when a executive or a company decides
like girlfriends
at the last minute too late.
I hate that.
And you don't get the final
so many iconic shows. Married with Children never got a girlfriend's never got a final one. It's just disrespectful.
Or even, and I think
just give them a TV movie at least.
You could do it even other ways wrong. Like remember Lost, they kept dragging it out. Like are we not?
That show never should have even went past the first episode. That should have been the end.
Well, so I think when you have a show that's good, it's beloved, and you give them this is your last season, you tell them this is your last season.
Yeah,
it's good for the viewer.
Yeah, I think it's great.
That. We're getting that now.
We're getting so many wonderful storylines, and they've jumped forward a little bit in time,
just three months.
And the character of Max, who is the youngest son of the Steve Martin character in the movie, but it's Peter Krause in the show, Adam, and Christina Braverman, who's the oldest of the family. And his son has Asperger's, and so they've really showed this evolution of this family, realizing something was different about their child, coming to a diagnosis place, figuring out how they were going to make this work with their family, with developing this child, dealing with the issues that arise when your child is in a mainstream environment but has special needs, and dealing with all of that. And they've gotten to this amazing place where this actor is so three-dimensional, so nuanced, so, I don't want to say normal because he has Asperger's and obviously he plays that way, because he does have these issues, but normal in terms of his needs as a human being. I feel like so often when somebody has a special needs character on a show, their entire entity becomes about that. And Max is not that. Max is about what he loves. Max is about the world he's trying to be in. Max is about how he's making his way in the world. And they've really crafted this amazingly complex story about this family and this character and how you deal with these issues in the real world.
Well, I think where they've really excelled is sort of in the nuance of it, right? The small little victories I've got some, family, there's some close to home stuff here. And I think they've done they clearly have somebody either as a consultant on the writing team this is very close to home. The character, many of the characters are very real and very raw, as we like about it. But the character of Max and the way that he interacts with his family and the just this last episode with the wanting to have this girlfriend and the sort of numerical do you like me on a 5 or 2? It was just brilliantly done and just so real. It's a very good combination of, I think,
and like Adam and his dad wanting this so badly for him to be able to have a girl he likes and know how to interact with her, and the mom being so afraid of him being rejected and not wanting him to look like a fool. They just really get to the heart of the humanness of it. And I love the show.
Did you see the scene where she's asking about, basically, are you here because your family's not around and you want to be with your family? Or are you here for Max? And she doesn't get the exact answer she wants.
But it's a good one.
It's an honest one.
She's like, I like hanging out with Max, but sometimes Max just wants to clean his lenses, and I'm not that's boring. So then I come hang out with you. It's like, oh, that makes complete sense. You know, yeah. Of course.
And she gave a little smile, almost like, holy cow.
Okay.
Yeah.
This girl does like my son, but my son is kind of irritating, and I need to understand that he is. Yeah. So I thought all of that was great and fantastic. And all the other storylines they have with Amber being pregnant and the issues at the luncheonette and the Harry Potter, I just love everybody on the show, everything about the show, and I'm, like I said, just filled with joy to get to watch it every week and happy that we get the opportunity to see it come to fruition.
It gets watched before How to Get Away with Murder. We're no longer live tweeting How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah, for sure. It gets watched immediately.
It's a good show. Very good show.
So we'll wrap up here with a little podcast, Danny. We gave a little shout out to Americans United again, but they have a new spinoff podcast that they've just launched, which is AUA Hope. And I'll just read the tagline from it, which is unity is the main idea behind the Americans United Again movement. We are about bringing people together to help find solutions for our country. One aspect of the movement is the idea of hope, the idea that each person has something to look forward to and to feel positive about. We are about uplifting people and healing our country on a mind, body, and soul level. Hope stands for helping our perspectives expand, and we hope to find new ways to inspire, uplift, and heal ourselves. So you can find that on iTunes at AUA Hope Podcast. They have had one podcast already. I listened to it. It's fantastic. And so they really are only featuring positive stories and positive information about our world, and really looking to bring some good news to people. It's admirable and wonderful, and I think that we can get, you know, very cynical in talking about a lot of these current event things, because the world's not great all the time, but there are good things happening. And
I could use some hope. Glass half full, half empty. I'm like, the glass is fucking cracked and about to break. And there's water all over the table.
It's so funny. So, yeah. So he talks about they have a Ray of Hope segment that they do with Davey Celeste. And they share some stories of prosperity and happiness and spread a little cheer. So you can, again, find that on iTunes at AUA Hope Podcast. Or you can go to their website, which is AmericansUnitedAgain.org, and just click the podcast page and you'll see it there. We love those guys. And it is hosted also by Ricky and Sherelle, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So anything else you want to add for end of our episode 10 here?
No, number 10, all double right. Digits.
Yeah, look for, again, this week, there'll be a second Interracial John podcast at some point. I think we're going to try and do it Thursday, but Wednesday you'll get a new episode 2 of the White Privilege podcast, and Friday, the very first episode of No Bitch Left Behind with Lady J and myself. So, all right, babe, high five.
We did it.
In the can.